And so I knew that my job was to get ratings. So you have to be a performer. But once you do that, and then you start to see the results of it, you're like, okay, wait, that's a toxic mix. I remember my father went to the hospital and almost died. He was a baker, and we had these marble floors, and he was scrubbing the floors, and he decided to get them really, really white. So he mixed ammonia with bleach. Well, you don't do that. Ammonia by itself, good. Bleach by itself, good. Don't mix these two. And I think that's what happened to me.
Hello, and welcome to the Fatherly Podcast. I'm your host, Joshua David Stein. Today, my guest is talk show provocateur Glenn Beck. Look, you either love or hate Glenn Beck. I have to say, for a long time, I counted myself as a hater. And after our interview, well, I still kind of am. But he's a dad of four. This is a podcast about dads. So recently we talked, he from his studio in Texas, me from mine in New York. As it turns out, yeah, we disagree on pretty much everything. But also, as both sons and fathers, we had a lot of common ground too. Now, what to do with that common ground, I don't know. But at least it's a start. Afterwards, our science editor Josh Krish and I discussed something that cropped up a lot with Glenn. The dangers and strengths of certainty. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Fatherly Podcast. My name is Joshua David Stein. I hope you enjoy the show.
I'm going to jump right into the questionnaire. What is your name?
Glenn Beck.
Occupation?
Entrepreneur.
Age?
53.
How old are your children?
11, 13, 25, and almost 30.
What are their names?
The youngest is Cheyenne Grace. Rafe William is my son at 13. Hannah Rose is my second oldest, and Mary Kate is my oldest.
Are they named after anyone in particular?
Only Mary. Mary is Mary Kate, and that was my mother's name, and she passed away when I was about 15 years old.
Do you have any cute nicknames for your children?
No, not that I'm going to share, because I torture them with them enough.
It doesn't need to be broadcast to the public.
I tell them all the time, you guys better behave or Dad's going to take you to the mall and dance.
Does that work for the 30-year-old?
Oh, my gosh.
Too?
It has worked. That's the best thing you can do. It's a bad thing that malls are going out of business because you just threaten them. I'm going to go to the center and I'm going to say, hey, everybody, this is my daughter and my son. Boo da boo boo, boo da boo, and just dance. Oh, you just threaten them, they behave every time.
On the other hand, you're a public figure. You could dance in a YouTube clip. It would go viral.
Yeah. It's. I don't know. There's something with them actually being there and me saying I'm their dad.
That's deeply humiliating
for
them.
Yes.
What do they call you?
My oldest still calls me daddy. The rest call me dad.
How often do you see them?
Every day. My oldest works for a charity that I've started right here in my studio complex. My son-in-law works here, and my kids either live with me or they live right next door. So we have dinner together, and we just are with each other and with the grandbabies.
Describe yourself as a father in three words.
Fun, loving, and present or stable.
Describe your father in three words.
Workaholic, distant, and confusing.
Still?
He passed away just a couple of years ago, and we were estranged at the time, and it was, I had a very complex relationship with my dad.
Which is still a source of confusion for you?
Some of it has been solved, some of it hasn't. I mean, this is going to sound horrible, but we weren't even allowed to have a funeral for my dad because of the family situation, and so it's been really difficult. He tried to be a good dad. He grew up in a family of abuse. His mother was abused by his dad, and he swore that he would never abuse his kids. And he didn't, but he married an abuser. He actually didn't become his dad, he became his mom. You know, my father, at one point, I was 16 years old, and I said to him, you know, I don't remember what we were even arguing about, but I tried to really get him, and I said, I'm never going to be like you. 20 minutes later, after I had stomped down the stairs and slammed my bedroom door, my dad knocked at my door and opened it up, and he was there with tears in his eyes, and he said, son, that is the best thing that you've ever said to me. When I was 30, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I bottomed out, and my father and I really never talked. We didn't have a bad relationship. We had no relationship. I called him up, and I said, "Dad, I don't know how to be your son." And he said, "I don't know how to be your dad." He said, "But I tell you what, if you'll promise to sit through the uncomfortable times with me, I'll do the same with you. You know, just sit through the silence until we find ourselves." And we did. And probably 3 years into it, we were best friends. But unfortunately, he's because of the situation in the family, my youngest sister, without getting into it, just had some problems with the family relationship. And I had told my dad, I said, "It's got to stop, Dad. It's got to stop." Because this abuse had been starting to spread throughout our family.
It's hard to contain.
And it's weird because it doesn't have to be physical abuse. Mental abuse is just as damaging. My sisters had spent a lifetime beating themselves up and having others do the same and just convincing them that they were worthless. I said, "Dad, it's got to stop." And he said, "I know." And it didn't. And about a year later, a huge crisis. And I've never told the story before, and I don't know if I should, but we met as a family, and it didn't go well. I said, "This is not the way we treat women in the family. This is not the way we treat each other. The nieces and nephews and the grandkids and my kids all need to know that's not acceptable behavior." We tried to go through family therapy, but it didn't work, and in the end, I was flying home to see my dad. He was in the hospital. He was slipping in and out of a coma. And all the way there, I just prayed so hard, "Please, Lord, just give my sisters, just give them a happy ending. Just give them just a moment with him." When I got there, each of them had that moment. He had said something really kind to each of them. And that was the greatest gift my dad could have given any of us.
It's a messy business, family.
It is. You know, life is pretty easy. It's the people that are confusing and tough. I can't believe I'm saying these things to you. I didn't cry over my dad's death. We didn't have a funeral, so there's not been an ending to it. I know I'm going to pay a price for this. We haven't, as a family, put him to rest. And it's weird because my mother committed suicide. And until I was probably 31, I called my sisters and I said, "Hey, we've got to meet." They said, "Okay." And I said, "I just got to talk to you guys." And so we sat down, and none of us were really close at the time. I sat down and I said, they said, "What do you want to talk about?" And we were sitting in my sister's living room. And I said, we got to talk about mom's suicide. My youngest sister, Michelle, she stood up and she pointed her finger in my face with just tears and rage and being frightened. And she said, "I did not kill her." And I said, "What? Where's that coming from?" And she said, "That's what you said to me." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Right before we found out about mom, she had been missing, and they had had a huge argument the night before, and I'm a 15-year-old boy, I'm a kid, and I look at my sister and I said, if she did anything, if she's dead, it's because of you and what you guys did last night." And we never spoke about it. And here she is, like 36, she'd been carrying that weight with her whole life. It destroyed me.
That dynamic is, I think, still present in your arc and the narrative of your life now, in the sense that obviously you've gone through something of a transformation over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
It seems like to some extent, although I don't want to put words in your mouth, you are in some ways trying to undo or make right something that you had done previously. You know, you'd been a very divisive and outspoken firebrand and caused this movement which has had catastrophic consequences. And now you've turned, and it's like you're sitting down again and you're saying, we need to talk about this thing.
Yeah.
the thing that I've done.
You know, I'll go with your description of me.
You don't have to co-sign it. That's my...
Isn't that what life is supposed to be? I mean, isn't it supposed to be you're doing your best and you screw it up, and then if you're brave enough or you're desperate enough, and I think I always fall into the desperate enough. It's so strange because the way you just described me is the exact opposite of who I am and who I've always been in my life. I shouldn't say always been. After I sobered up, who I've always been in my private life. You know, somehow or another, it spiraled and I really did my best. You know, there comes a time when you're like, wait a minute. I know I'm not the person that people are describing me as. So it's my actions that are making people say that. So what is it I'm doing and how can I stop it and how can I repair it? I guess that's just, you know, part of, you know, being an alcoholic and understanding recovery. Just surrender.
I think the interesting thing for me about that narrative is because of your position as such a powerful speaker, and not in a derogatory way, but like a showman, a very compelling showman, your words have had so much power over so many people, and your opinions have so much power in this sort of line between showmanship and reality. And
so can I say that is the problem? That was the problem. I haven't changed what I've believed. I am a showman. And I thought, okay, I believe these things. And how do I get people to talk about the things that nobody wants to talk about? Nobody really wants to talk about them. How do we get there? And so I knew that my job was to get ratings. So you have to be a performer. But once you do that, and then you start to see the results of it, you're like, okay, wait, that's a toxic mix. I remember my father went to the hospital and almost died. He was a baker and we had these marble floors and he was scrubbing the floors and he decided to get them really, really white. So he mixed ammonia with bleach. You don't do that. Ammonia by itself, good. Bleach by itself, good. Don't mix these two. I think that's what happened to me.
The Fatherly Podcast is brought to you by Cheese Dippers by The Laughing Cow. Every kid's got an imagination all their own. Whether they're racing monster trucks, playing teacher, or dreaming of setting foot on Mars, even the wildest imaginations are hungry for more. Feed your kid's appetite for adventure with Cheese Dippers by The Laughing Cow. With perfectly crunchy breadsticks and creamy cheese, it's a crunchable, dippable, enjoy however you wantable snack that's always a favorite. Plus, it's made to go anywhere their imagination takes them. Cheese Dippers by The Laughing Cow. Snack like you. And now back to the show. What do you think about the role of showmanship in your redemption as well? Because obviously you haven't gone through this redemption privately or solely privately. Even the redemption itself has kind of become a spectacle. Does that undermine the...
No, I think that's it's an honest thing. I mean, honestly, you know, I have, I don't know, 150 employees. I go away to the mountains, everything stops and everybody loses their job. Not good. But there have been many times in the last 5 years that I have said, shut up, just shut up and go away. To me, I've said that and I've wanted to, but I don't, because I still believe in things and I still believe that, you know, I can help make things better.
I have the same sort of gesture as a writer. I just share everything in my life and I send it out there like a little emissary of my emotional state. What I'm realizing now, seems like this is a loop that closed for you, is that it doesn't just go out into the ether and evaporate, that it has real effects for people, both the audience, but also in your own life.
And you know what? It's when you put it out there, there's also the responsibility of others on what are you going to do with it? I put it out there and, you know, you can look at that and say, oh, he's doing this because of X, Y, or Z. Okay, well, that's your choice to look at it that way. When it comes to my self-reflection stuff, my audience, I think, hates it. They're always like, why are you questioning yourself so much? And I'm like, I think we all should. If you aren't made uncomfortable by somebody, at least once a week, or an idea, or something that you've read or watched by yourself. If you haven't taken the time to reflect and go, geez, man, you know, that was really not cool. You know, maybe they're right. Maybe those people who I've always been saying they're so wrong, maybe they're right. Or maybe they're saying this because of something I'm doing that I don't think I'm doing, but that's the way they're interpreting it.
Do you have a phrase for the redemption of Glenn Beck? What do you call in your own head this shift, this mental shift?
I don't think I call it anything probably other than unpopular.
Okay, so before this moment of deep unpopularity of Glenn Beck, did you have a private, personal life change as well? Did this moment of awakening?
Not necessarily connected in my head, at least at the time.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was up in New York. I was living a very nice life and had an apartment with, had to be a 200-degree view of New York right on the park, and, you know, just beautiful. And everything that I've ever dreamt of, you know, as a kid, that was my life. I had gone the night to see Spider-Man with my kids, and Bono was there. I get a message halfway through, hey, Bono would like to say hi. Can you wait after the show and go backstage? And I'm like, Bono. I mean, you got to be kidding me. Bono.
Yeah. I also just like that you get random text messages from like the celebrity gods who are like, these two.
It's really weird. And it's really weird that he'd like to meet you and say, hi, do you have time? And it's like, oh, no, I'm sorry. I've got a very pressing appointment at McDonald's in a few minutes. So right. I can't do it. For a kid that was never a cool kid, and a conservative is not a cool kid, so all the way through my life, I'm just never cool, to have that moment, it was the day that my wife and I had finally said, tomorrow, I'm going into Roger Ailes' office and I'm going to quit. And we had thought about it and prayed about it for a long time. That was happening the next day. I get back to the apartment. All the lights are off.
Having met Bono,
having this like the coolest day of my life. And I walk into my movie-like apartment, floor-to-ceiling windows. The whole city is right there in front of me. And I walk to one of the corners, which is just two points of glass coming together. And I'm like standing, you know, 50 stories above the street. It was just amazing. I said to my wife, how can this be right? Look at the access that we're getting. Look at the things we can now take and start to move in other ways, and we can influence people. All she said to me was, I'm going to bed. And she went to bed, and I sat there with my forehead on the cold glass. I just felt in everything in me, it's almost like an audible voice, if you don't leave now, you won't leave with your soul. And I think that was right. I was on the verge of just losing my soul because I was starting to want it.
Did you talk to your kids about it?
I talked to my kids. I was at CNN that Christmas. I take a job with Fox, and I'm moving over there. Before I took the job, I sat all my kids down, and I said, I'm thinking about taking this job, but if I do, our life is going to change a lot. It's not going to be popular. Now, I didn't think it would be as unpopular as it turned out to be, or as popular, but I said, our life is going to change. And I said, so we're going to vote as a family. Are we in or are we out? And when everybody said in, I asked the children, I said, I need you to keep a journal of who I am for two reasons. I don't want to lose me. And people are going to say things about your dad. And I want you to remember the truth, because we could get to the end of this and there could be just nothing but bad stuff about me. I want you to know who I really am. I want you to remember who I really am.
But to your point earlier, I think if everyone thought this about me, then it's something I'm doing with my actions. And if my actions are who I am, if that's how it's perceived, then that is who I became.
Perception is reality.
Yeah.
Perception is reality. And you just don't mix those two chemicals together. You don't take entertainment and really a rock solid belief, whatever it is, that's strident. The one thing that made me popular and makes people like Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or anybody popular is certainty. People want to look at a leader and they say, I got it, and we're going this way. It's what's killing us. We're all absolutely certain that whatever it is we believe is the right way or the truth, and we're certain that the other people are wrong, and so we don't listen to each other anymore.
I agree so strongly with what you're saying. I guess that what I keep thinking, though, is because you were in a position, you were partially, I guess, responsible for creating this environment, where does responsibility and culpability come in? Like, you've had this moment of awakening, but you still have that culpability which kind of clings to you. And what do you do with that?
Well, you do what I've been trying to do, repair it as much as you possibly can. I don't agree with that I'm largely responsible for the mood in the country. I think we're all really responsible. Until we look inside of ourselves and say, you know what? We're all responsible in some degree or another, some more than others. And I take my share, I'll take extra. But everybody has to do this. Everybody has to look at themselves and say, you know, what role have I played?
You haven't changed your opinions, but you've changed the means by which you express them. I guess that's accurate. Obviously, at Fatherly, we are concerned with children and raising children and all that stuff. I'd spoken to Mark Barden from Sandy Hook Promise. You've advocated against gun control and against some of these issues, which I think really affect children. Speaking to Mark, it affects me too, and obviously as a human. I would not be emotionally or intellectually honest if I didn't ask you about those opinions now, if you still have them.
On gun control? Yeah, I look at the Bill of Rights as natural rights, nature's God and nature's laws. So I believe in the right of self-protection. Nobody is crying over the idiot that runs into a cave and just like, I want to get a picture with the bear cubs when mommy wakes up and rips him limb from limb. No, everybody says, you're being stupid. Of course the bear is going to do that. It's a natural law to be able to protect yourself. It's not a problem with the gun. It's like racism. Racism isn't a white problem or a black problem. It's a human problem. Violence.
That a certain type of person feels much more strongly than another type.
I don't know. What was that?
You said racism's not a white problem. It's not a black problem. It's a human problem.
Yes.
I agree. Humans do have that problem. Nonetheless, one segment of the population feels it much more strongly than the other. White people exert
racism.
Yeah, but
I think that's a very American point of view. I mean, go other places on the planet where racism is just as strong and the colors could be completely different. Look at the Middle East. I mean, it's our culture,
right?
That has raised it this way. When it comes to guns, we have to do everything we can to make sure that unstable people do not have access to guns, that there's so much data that shows these, especially school shooters, they're on all kinds of medications. They should never have had access to guns in the house. But I believe in the right of self-defense. A woman has somebody coming and they're going to rape her. If she has taken the time to learn how to use a gun. The most dangerous thing you can do is buy a gun and then never learn how to use it. You're going to get yourself killed or other people killed. But if you are a responsible human being and you're using it for self-protection, I think you have a right to do that.
I appreciate the tone. It's reasonable, you know, and it's not yelling. I couldn't disagree more with what you're saying. Do you think even if our tones are civil, right, at some point, there needs to be a conflict because you believe in one thing that you are certain is right. I believe equally strongly that the other thing is.
I think that is the problem.
Certainty.
Yeah, it's certainty.
I'm going to jump right back into the questionnaire. So you're off the hook for a second.
Okay. All right.
You're going to get back on that hook. What are your strengths as a father?
I am good at diffusing. Believe it or not.
And fusing.
Yeah, and fusing. At this point, I know who I am. I am at this point not afraid of being who I am with my kids. I'm not afraid of, Dad, I've got to do this because that's Dad's do, or I got to do. I'm just who I am.
You said earlier off air, for a long time, you were scared of your kids. Tell me about that.
I'm riddled with ADD. And so I can't sit, you know, and play like Candyland. Please, it should come with a rope that I could hang myself with. I'm not good at sitting with the little kids when they're really little and just playing mindless games. It scared me because of my dad. I didn't know how to relate. I didn't learn how to play. Yeah, I was working in my dad's bakery when I was 8. So I didn't know how to play. I didn't know how to hang out. I was always working. I was always doing something. And that has made me successful, but it's also made me really socially awkward. I am exactly the opposite of what you would think. If I'm in a crowded room, at a cocktail party, that I'd rather play Candyland than that.
When you're talking about your family story, and even me, I come from a broken home and raising my own sons, I feel like because of my own family history, maybe I'm just going to fuck them up like I'm fucked up.
I mean, oh, I know.
I'm not telling you anything you don't know. You had a fucked up family history.
Oh, yeah. It's a shipwreck. And then on top of it, add lots of success. There's nothing like thinking, what is this going to do to my kids when I walk out onto a stage and, you know, there's 20,000 people who are adoring fans. This happened with my son walking down the streets of Anchorage, Alaska. And this woman came, I mean, screaming across the street and ran over and pushed her finger in my chest. "We don't want your kind here. You get out of our town." I mean, just, and my security had to come and take my son away. And that was the first time my son had seen that.
How did you explain it to him?
I said that I talk about things that a lot of people disagree with. Some agree. People feel passionately, and I feel passionately, and I understand her. This is probably the last year at Fox I was up there, because I responded to her. Security took my son away, and I just looked at her, and I just said to her, "I love you." And that made her even more angry.
To be honest, I would be pretty fucking pissed off.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no.
What are your weaknesses as a father?
I'm really... It doesn't matter if I'm dating or married or raising. I'm clueless with girls. Clueless.
Those are three very different relationships with women.
No, I know that. I know that. But in any relationship, I'm clueless. I can't tell you how many times I have said something and my wife would look at me, the kids would walk out and she'd just look at me like, "What the hell were you thinking?" And I'm like, "What, is that bad? You don't say that." No, yeah. You don't say that.
Especially right now, you talked about Roger Ailes as well. I think the whole milieu was and is clueless about women.
Yeah, I don't mean it that way. I just mean it as, I don't know. Do you have daughters?
No, I have two sons.
So you won't be able to relate to this, because I expected to feel the same way about my son. I thought it was just a void in me. There is, you know, I know what my son is thinking. I can see him across the table. I can see him across the room, and I know what he's thinking because I've been there. I know it. I've not been a 13-year-old girl, and I don't know if you know this, they don't think like we do.
Yeah.
And so there's just this awkwardness at times. I mean, I have a really good relationship with my daughters. I mean, we go on father-daughter dates all the time, though we still do. We talk, but we relate differently than my wife does with them. And the same with my son. My wife, it's funny because, I look now at my wife and she'll say something to my son and I'll look at her like, no, that's not going to be helpful. There's a difference between male and female. There's just a difference. And it could be just that I lived that life.
What is your favorite activity to do with your children? That is your special father and kid thing.
I guess if I had to put it, reading with my kids, just talking with my kids, something simple like playing cards, which is just a way to just talk to them, just hanging out with them, I really enjoy.
What heirloom did your father give to you, if any?
Nothing physical.
Doesn't have to be physical.
An inquisitive mind.
What heirlooms do you want to leave to your children, if anything?
I want them to remember the safety of the family, the stability, the love of the family.
Describe the dad special for dinner.
I'm hoping my wife isn't listening. It's McGriddles. The greatest day in my life was the day that they made McGriddles after 10:30 in the morning.
And this comes from the son of a baker.
That's right.
That's right. I'm the worst at that because my father was, you know, we never had sweets or anything because we worked at the bakery. So everything, I would trade my German chocolate cake. I'd go to, you know, school and my lunchbox would be fresh bread, you know, a sandwich with fresh bread and German chocolate cake. I would trade that for a bologna sandwich on Wonder Bread and a Twinkie any day.
You didn't know how good you had it, man.
I didn't know how good I had it.
Well, Glenn, thank you for being my guest on the Fatherly Podcast.
Joshua, thank you so much. God bless.
I wanted to bring into the conversation Josh Krish, our science editor.
Well, Josh, I just had a somewhat uncomfortable conversation with Glenn Beck.
I missed Glenn?
You did.
Ah.
Sucks for you. I think the thing that really stuck in my craw, in a way, is part of his whole redemption narrative is that he feels terrible about the method of delivery of his opinions, vitriolic, over the top, divisive, but still clings to those opinions on racism and gun control, two things we talked about. His main takeaway of what he did wrong was in the tone. He says his tone was too certain, and that certainty is the enemy of dialogue. As parents, certainty is something that we struggle with in talking to our children. We want to impart certainty with some things and impart a sense of wonder or openness or spaciousness or lack of certainty in others. You're our science editor. Science, of all the disciplines, the one that seems most embedded in certainty. Some things are true, some things are not true, some things are certain, and some things are uncertain. Talk to me about how you, as a scientific mind, as a father, someone who has been steeped in facts, how you deal with certainty and whether you see certainty as something that's harmful for dialogue.
Yeah, it's definitely not harmful for dialogue if you're right. Certainly.
Well, that was Josh Krish.
Glenn Beck is right when he says that he should cut back on the vitriol. I don't think you ever want to teach anything with vitriol to your students or to your children. But as far as certainty, no, there's nothing wrong with being certain if you have good reason to be certain. And I certainly would hope, I certainly would hope that if Glenn Beck is sure about his opinions on gun control, on racism, on women, that he would say them with certainty. To introduce doubt that's not really there is pandering, first of all. Scientifically speaking, from an educational perspective, is not a particularly effective way to teach.
What do you mean?
I mean that if there isn't really a controversy, artificially crafting one so that you seem to be even-handed doesn't actually convey much information to students, studies have shown.
Even as members of the media, false balance or ideas of objectivity in terms of reporting equally side A and side B,
sure,
without making an evaluation haunt us.
In science journalism, this was the biggest thing with climate change. For the longest time, it was considered even-handed and good journalism to throw in a quote from a climate denier, even though the overwhelming scientific consensus was that it was happening.
Right. That approach empowers the weaker argument. You know, racism isn't a black and white thing. It's a human thing.
The entire view of this, that we should be listing all of the arguments and letting people choose as media professionals, the myth that it's a parent or teacher or journalist's job to collect information and throw it at people without bias is ridiculous. The idea is to curate. You don't tell your children everything. You curate what they discover through you. And you curate the information to make sure that what they get is something that you're comfortable with, both intellectually and morally. Now, I don't know if I agree with what he thinks is most factual or most compelling, but certainly the answer for Glenn or for anybody else who has controversial opinions isn't to say them nicer.
Right. So how do you teach uncertainty?
I didn't find any studies on how to teach uncertainty as a parent, but there is one famous study on how to teach it in the classroom, specifically in science classrooms where there's always a push to teach both sides, I'm using air quotes, both sides of evolution.
Right.
whether it's creationism versus the evolutionary model, natural selection, Darwinism, all of the bugaboos. So that controversy comes up all the time.
And teaching controversy, just so we're all clear, is a way of teaching uncertainty.
Yeah. And according to the people pushing it, it's a way of teaching intellectual rigor, how to analyze an argument and pick a side based on its merits. Mm-hmm. And on paper, it sounds like a really good idea. You know, everybody needs more opinions. Everybody needs to hear more voices as a general rule. And teaching students to interrogate information certainly isn't a bad thing. But there was one study in an incredibly boring sounding journal called Trends in Ecology and Evolution.
I want to subscribe.
Yeah, it's actually more interesting than it sounds, but it can't get much worse than it sounds. So there's that.
It's exactly as interesting as it sounds.
In 2003, Eugene Scott and Glenn Branch over at the National Center for Science Education put out a study on how to determine which controversies to teach in a science classroom and which ones to leave alone, when teaching the controversy was of benefit to students and when it's not. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of thing that if we modify it slightly could work well for parents. It could even work for Glenn Beck. So it's worth looking into.
I'll tell him.
You let him know. Of the five, the two that strike me as the most important are that the resources for each side of the controversy should be comparable in availability and in quality. In order to teach a controversy, there has to be two real sides, two people who can advocate for each side, so they have to be available. And also, these two people advocating for each side need to be of equal quality in their scope of research.
That's great, but as a parent, when I'm talking to Achilles about, I don't know, God, I'm not going to call an atheist and a rabbi into the room so they can present their sides of the... I'm not going to have people there. How does this apply? I understand in academe how they would, but how does this apply at home?
Even in school, they wouldn't really need to call these people in. The point is that they should exist. There should be an intellectual who's thought about this and researched this, who has the clout to say something on each side of the argument. So it's worth discussing a God controversy if you believe that there is such a thing as a well-educated atheist who has thought through God and rejected it, and a well-educated clergy member who has thought through God and accepted it.
Thinking about the parts of the conversation with Glenn where I did feel like I resonated with him, they were the parts where he was talking about, as a father, how he went about expressing to his children and showing them an example that he didn't always get it right. And I actually do think that even though I disagree strongly with him vis-a-vis certainty, because I do think there is a right and I do think there is a wrong, I very much value him providing an example for his children of, this is what it looks like when you've made a mistake. This is how you try to fix it.
Yeah, I think those are probably two separate questions. The question of whether you should teach something you're uncertain about so that your children see you uncertain, and whether you should show your children what it looks like when you revise your opinions, are two completely different questions. The answer is children should see a certain amount of both. They should see you revise your opinions because you're a human who's going to do that, and then watching that process teaches them humility and teaches them that they can interrogate their own beliefs and ultimately come to change them sometimes.
But it doesn't teach them that there's no beliefs to be had or that believing in something is bad.
And you know, Glenn Beck's not alone. There definitely is a movement among intellectuals that it is somehow more intellectual to be unsure about things than it is to be sure about things. I'm not sure where this movement started, but I think it's infected liberals as much as it's infected conservatives.
Well, it's a post-structuralist argument.
Yeah, I don't like it one bit. Maybe it's because I'm your science editor, and I don't appreciate calling a source and asking, does this cause cancer? And they're like, well, there are many opinions, and I wouldn't want to say that my 30 years of research in cancer can definitively say anything at all, because other opinions exist from people who haven't researched cancer. As somebody who does science, that's very frustrating to me. But I don't think it's just Glenn Beck. I think it's pervasive now that if you sound less sure of yourself, people will like you better. And I think it's very misguided. As far as I can tell from the research, people don't listen to you more when you're unsure of yourself. They listen to you more when you're honest about the limitations of what you know. So if there is a controversy, a legitimate scientific discussion being had right now, and we don't know which one's right yet, then sounding unsure is appropriate because the science is unsure.
You are sure that you're unsure.
Right. But when you know something, do your kids benefit from you pretending you don't know so that they'll learn how to interrogate an argument and that they'll learn what a controversy looks like? Look, if you're so sure about everything that you have to construct uncertainty to demonstrate it, then you have bigger problems.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening to the Fatherly Podcast. I'm your host, Joshua David Stein. Join me next week when I welcome to the studio Van Jones, host of The Van Jones Show and the author of Beyond the Messy Truth. Today's episode was executive produced by Sandy Smallins and engineered by Dave Savage. Theme music by Kyle Forcer, with a little help from my son, Augie Hirenstein. If you enjoyed the podcast, hey, give us a rating, a high one, and subscribe on iHeartRadio or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, that's all I got. Augie, you want to say something?
Boo, 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 pee, pee. Yes. Butt cheek, the penis is being...